Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. Hey, what's up, everyone? Before we get to today's show, just a few quick updates. First off, I'd like to ask for your help with our latest survey, this time around on the Python data science ecosystem. This is our second year exploring this space, and we'd love to have your input. If you use Python for data science, please visit twimlai.com/pythonsurvey to take the survey. The survey will only take a few minutes to complete, and three lucky submissions will receive a $25 Amazon gift card. Speaking of languages, we are super excited to announce the great machine learning language UnDebate. Join us for a thoughtful discussion exploring the strengths, weaknesses, and approaches of popular and emerging programming languages for machine learning like Python, R, C++, Swift, Julia, Clojure, and more, and an opportunity for you to engage with experts and peers on the topic. It's not too late to let us know the languages you'd like to see included and who you'd like to see representing them. Send me your suggestions via Twitter at @SamCharrington or hit me up at sam@twimlai.com. Visit twimlai.com/languages for more information or to register. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone, I am on the line with Marsal Gavalda. Marsal is head of machine learning for the commerce platform at Square. Marsal, welcome to the TWIML AI podcast.
Thank you so much, Sam. Very excited to be in your podcast.
It's great to have an opportunity to speak with you, and I'm looking forward to digging into, you know, how ML is working at Square, what you're up to. But before we do that, share a little bit about your background. What got you interested in machine learning, and what are some of your interest areas?
Yeah, sure. Happy to share my sort of life story here. I grew up in Barcelona, Catalonia, Spain, right? Uh-huh. Which actually is in the news still quite a bit because there's kind of an unresolved conflict between Catalonia and the rest of Spain. And a lot of it is based on language. So growing up there, I got very interested in languages because I wondered, you know, how come half of my classmates speak Catalan and the other half speak Spanish? When if you look at the history, right, as the Roman Empire extended throughout Europe, they were all supposed to be speaking Latin, right? And yet Latin gave rise to Italian in one place, Romanian, French, Portuguese, Spanish, Catalan, all the languages that we now call Latin or Romance languages. So that got me kind of curious about where do languages come from and how do they evolve? What is common across all languages? What is unique? Take the word for window, right? In Catalan, window is finestra, which actually is the exact same word as in Italian, finestra. Yeah. Very close to the French fenêtre, right? Even close to the German fenster, even though German is not even a Latin language. Whereas in Spanish, I don't know, Sam, if you know any Spanish.
It's ventana, right?
Exactly, yes. And where is the etymology of ventana? Where does it come from? Ventana comes from viento, which means wind. And it's super interesting because the word origin of in English of window also comes from like Old Germanic wind aug. So like a wind's eyelet, a little hole for the wind to go through, which if it's, you know, what would you call now something for air or wind to go through that doesn't have a glass? You would call that a vent, right? Mm-hmm. So you have window and ventana, all these sort of related to wind. And on the other hand, there's finestra, right? Which apparently
this might be the first episode of my language podcast.
Oh, yeah. Let's expand our horizons.
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting that you're starting off with this conversation about language is something that I'm super excited about. I don't spend nearly enough time studying it, but this conversation around the etymology of words reminds me of a book that I read, The History of the English Language, that kind of goes through. The thing that I remember most vividly from that book is this concept of the great language shift. I don't know if something similar happened in the the great vowel shift, if something similar happened in the Romance languages. But in English, there was this period of time in which the vowels all shifted in the sounds that they made, and it's apparent when you look at like Beowulf and other writing, and you see these words that don't really make any sense until you realize that there was this vowel shift anyway, I just
And one very interesting thing about English is that it basically has this duality of vocabulary, because English is a Germanic language, but then it had a huge influence of Latin through French, right?
Yeah.
And so you get these pairs, you know, what is the difference between freedom and liberty? Well, it's really kind of the same. It's just, you know, freedom is the Germanic one and liberty is the Roman. On the other hand, there's also these super fun pairs like pig and pork or cow and beef, where the animal, the word for the animal is the Germanic one, whereas the one for the dish or the cooked thing is the Latin one. Even the difference between kitchen and cuisine, right? Look at that. Is cuisine is just kitchen in French, right? But so word is endlessly languages are endlessly fascinating. There's also not just the words, but also the constituents. Like in Japanese, you say the girl a book reads, right? Mm-hmm. You put the verb at the end, which incidentally is also how Yoda talks. So it just appears to kind of, it lends more gravitas if you at the end of the sentence, the verb place. but of course, so the interesting thing is that all languages have nouns and verbs, which is not surprising because this is how we humans perceive the world. There's sort of static objects like a cup, and then there's actions. You pour into the cup or you drink from the cup, right? But then the way in which you put these building blocks together is more arbitrary. But of course, fundamentally, all languages have the same expressive power. It's just that certain languages tend to put more emphasis in certain aspects. Like another cool example is in Chinese, you cannot just say brother or sister. You have to specify whether it's older brother or younger sister, right? There's like four different words for sibling.
So an interest in kind of a political interest in language drove an interest in languages broadly, it sounds like. And is that what brought you into machine learning?
Yes. And AI? Well, so that's one aspect I've always been interested in, and I've tried to like learn a few languages, et cetera. I sort of can mumble my way through a few. But then the other piece is technology. Don't put me on the spot, but basically, so Catalan and Spanish, German, English, and then Chinese and Japanese a little bit. I can know some basic stuff. And then actually other languages like French and Italian, Portuguese, just through sort of Roman's osmosis, right? They're so close that you can basically understand.
Cool.
Yeah. But then the other piece is sort of technology. One day my dad brought home an HP 85, one of the early home computers, a beautifully designed machine, right? So a CRT monochrome screen, magnetic cartridge for storage, a thermal printer, this built-in keyboard, and then some manuals that were very well done and taught you how to program. At that time, that was in BASIC. So that's how I sort of got hooked into coding, and I ended up studying computer science as an undergrad in Barcelona at the UPC, the Universitat Politécnica de Catalunya, which is, I think, now goes by Barcelona Tech. But when I finished, I realized that there was this sort of nascent field at the time called computational linguistics, now better known as sort of maybe language technologies, which is this attempt of getting computer systems to understand aspects of human language. And then I thought, wow, that's absolutely amazing. I can sort of combine my two interests in languages and technology. So after my undergrad in Barcelona, I did 1 year in Germany at the University of Karlsruhe. And then I came to the US for grad school. I was at Carnegie Mellon for quite a few years because I first did a master's in computational linguistics, and then I stayed for a PhD in computer science and in language technologies.
Okay.
So awesome. I started working on things like speech recognition, machine translation. Some of the early what we're calling sort of end-to-end speech translation, which was doing the recognition and then a fair amount of a minimum amount of understanding so that you could sort of generate into a target language. Something that now is more common, but 25 years ago was sort of a pioneering work with Alex Weibel, the Janus project, and some other researchers.
Okay, nice. And I've got a note here that you went to CMU with Manuela Veloso. We've talked, obviously lots of folks on the podcast
have
gone through CMU.
Yeah.
But were you there at the same time? Do you know one?
Yeah, I had her as a teacher, as a professor, of course. Yes.
Oh, wow.
I think ML or some. I remember an assignment that I did for Manuela Veloso, which was to automatically create crossword puzzles. Not to solve them, but to create them.
Right? Okay.
That was one of the assignments I remember. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. Cool. And so how long have you been at Square?
So at Square, it's 3 years now. I spent some time doing like speech analytics for like call centers. And then I moved more into a kind of the startup world. It was with MindMeld, with Yik Yak. And then 3 years ago, I together with some other team from Yik Yak, we joined Square.
Okay. And you're particularly focused on commerce at Square. I imagine there are lots of different ways that machine learning is used at the company, but what is the you know, are yes. there a handful of core use cases for ML at right. commerce?
Yeah. The cool thing about Square is that sort of machine learning is foundational to the company, right? The reason we can be so open as a platform and allow for anybody to sign up to be a Square seller or even a Square developer through our API is also because we have the mechanisms in place to watch out for bad actors, right? Anytime that you deal with money, you have to watch out for all kinds of fraud and risk. And so to some extent, risk management is sort of the foundational piece of the application of ML at Square. But then over the course of the years, because we're not just the people know about the little white reader that, you know, converts a smartphone into a credit card or a point of sale system. But actually, we've expanded quite a lot the offerings in terms of products and services. You can run a small business just using Square with things like inventory management and even team management. We can do payroll and taxes for your employees. So that on the one hand, obviously it's an excellent way of helping our sellers. On the other, from a risk perspective, you also have to watch out for sort of new avenues for sort of malicious users. I can give you a cool example, which is we have a product called Square Marketing, right, which allows our sellers to have a conversation with their buyers through email campaigns. And we provide some nicely designed templates so that they can show their latest products or loyalty program, et cetera. Except that in a couple of occasions, we saw that that was being misused as phishing attempt, right? So someone would craft what looked like was supposed to be an email marketing campaign that actually contained some link to some nefarious phishing site. So what happens there, sort of ML to the rescue, right? So we quickly develop a classifier so that before an email gets sent, it gets inspected. And then we look at what are some signals here that tells us that something is off. And of course you can think of, well, usually there's a button associated with that, sort of with a call to action, with a phishing attempt. So we can inspect the URL and compare whether the domain of the URL matches the URL of the seller if they have a website. If it doesn't, that's a bit of a red flag. But interestingly, and you know, going back to the language, just by looking at a couple of examples, you can see that the language being used in the phishing attempts is very different from the normal marketing campaign. In fact, it tends to be much more negative, right? It says, problem with your account, go fix it. And so interestingly, as I'm sure you know, there's this technique in natural language processing called sentiment analysis, where you can take a bunch of text and basically map it onto a single number, you know, -1 sad to +1 happy. So the sentiment polarity is a signal that we now use for this classifier. And not by itself, but in sort of conjunction with other features.
Interesting.
And of course, now, I always say, you know, don't tell this to the bad guys, right? Otherwise, they're going to adapt and start crafting marketing campaigns saying, wonderful opportunity.
Press this button so we could have
that's you. Right. That's right. Wouldn't you want to freshen up your password?
Yeah.
So the overall point here is that anytime that you have a new product, anytime that you have a new API, you obviously have to also think about, you know, how could this be misused and how can we sort of protect against that? So managing risk remains one of the sort of largest applications of ML at Square. Another one, though, which is also very interesting, is just being able to be better at automating operations and being able to, for example, do more accurate marketing campaigns. As our number of products grows, it's also important to be able to let a certain subset of our sellers know about that new product, the ones that are going to be most interested in them, right? So a good example is Square Appointments. Square Appointments, if you're a hairdresser, and you don't want to be on the phone all the time, you know, are you open at 3? Can I come in tomorrow? You'd rather have a self-serve external portal where people can just, a calendar where people can book themselves, right? So that's exactly what Square Appointments is. And actually, we're offering this for free for an initial location. So we've had a lot of success. But then the next question is, among our millions of sellers, who would benefit the most from Square Appointments, right? Because we don't want to send like a mass email that people are going to consider spam if they're just a little kiosk and they're not like booking doesn't make sense for that particular seller. Mm-hmm. So obviously we can do that by sort of what we call MCC, merchant category code. But also there's some cool ways of kind of inspecting the items and services that are in our sellers' catalogs to understand whether there are certain things that are being booked by time, right? Is there any place in the description of your item where you mention 1 hour or a half an hour? Well, that's a perfect candidate for Square Appointments. And so we're able to sort of use also ML to have a much more targeted marketing campaigns. And so that's kind of automating operations. And then there's... category. Yes, and then there's a third category, which you can think of driving sort of product features, something that is visible to the seller, right? And so a couple of examples are, we now are able to make suggestions in your catalog, like based on what type of business you are, or what type of items you already have in your catalog, we're able to sort of suggest something that other products that you may want to carry. Or a simple thing is when you create a new item, let's say you're a bakery, which by the way, it's interesting. We can also know what type of business you are, obviously based on your name, right? If you're Josephine's Bakery, you're a bakery. Also, this is a true story. If you're, Rolling Scones, you're also a bakery. And then, so we're able to, based on your name and certainly based on the type of items that you sell, have a
I love that good name. Where is that business?
It's a real bakery somewhere. I'm not sure. I think maybe Seattle. We can look it up. So we know what type of business you are based also on a little bit of sort of this sort of behavior, right? Not just the name, but also the items that you sell and the ticket sizes, etc. When you create an item, let's say you're a bakery and you create a new item called croissant, well, we know that there's going to be certain very common variations like plain, almond, chocolate, right? And we actually, what, you don't like croissants?
No, I was thumbs down, plain, almond, medium, chocolate up. And then
yes, it's a progression, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, and so we kind of were able to auto-suggest that because those are sort of, you know, because we understand a bit of the domain, but in a way that is sort of fully automated. So that's one example, suggestions in the catalog. And then another very new area where we're just starting with is with what we call the Square Assistant. This is the result of an acquisition we did last year of Eloquent Labs. We now call it the Conversations team. And they recently released Square Assistant right now for appointments, which means that when a buyer gets a reminder of one of these Square appointments, they can now reply and say, "Oh yes, I'll be there," or "Oh shoot, can I come in tomorrow instead?" Mm-hmm. And right now, so the assistant is able to respond on the seller's behalf about the appointments. And so this is kind of a new area where I think there's a lot of potential.
So when you have a business, you know, for which ML is so fundamental. Yeah, I'm thinking about how you kind of manage a portfolio of projects and how you kind of organize around that. You know, it's very different from, you know, an enterprise that is, you know, has some other business and is thinking about how can we, you know, take advantage of machine learning. Let's spin up a project here, spin up a project there.
Right.
You know, here you've got you know, I can imagine, you know, every product, every feature effort you're thinking about, you know, an engineer is thinking in the back of their head is, you know, is my goal best served by machine learning or something simpler, you know, and that might have you with a lot of, you know, places where you're trying to have a lot of impact across the product portfolio. How do you?
Yes. So what I would say to that is, it's really the case that at Square, I guess we're sort of in a sort of lucky situation where sort of technology and ML was understood as a kind of a core component from the get-go. But for any other organization, I think there's some steps that anybody can take, which is the first one is just kind of more awareness, right? So provide some broad machine learning training so that people at least sort of understand a little bit of the concepts of how do you have this. So the key thing about machine learning is that it's something that learns from the data, learns from experience, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we do even at Square is we have a training that we call ML for Everyone, where we teach these concepts. And then we follow that up with a brainstorming session. Like, now that we know a little bit about ML, let's think about how could ML help your team or your customers, and we come up with specific examples, right? Okay. And actually, it's cool to also use the, you know, Andrew Ng's sort of heuristic about what ML can do. He says any task that a human can do in about a second of thought, about 1 second of cognitive effort, is something that we can probably automate, right? And of course, it's not a perfect heuristic. Like, you know, chess playing, we would already take way longer than a second to decide the next move. Yeah. But it gives us a little bit of some parameters. And so that gives us a lot of ideas to our teams. And then, of course, you need to kind of aggregate and prioritize. But that typically leads. So a lot of these ideas are very good, but then you realize that they depend on the availability of data. So the third point is, from an organizational perspective, to treat data as a first-class citizen, meaning that it's not that you have some sort of analytics as an afterthought of some, you know, kind of looking over and trying to, you know, look at some logs, but rather have the data already have a, when you design a functionality, when you design a product or an API, already have in mind which data is this service going to consume, and most importantly, which data this service will be able to generate so that other services can easily use that data. Right. So there's quite a bit of work in terms of standardizing how we produce that data, and then also kind of the data infrastructure to have kind of a common repository of that data, and not just the raw data, but then also have you sort of aggregate it into sort of useful features. Meaning, for example, in terms of transactions, you don't have to in some cases, you don't need to know every single transaction about a seller. You just want to know what their average weekly processing volume is, right? And so you aggregate that into a signal, and you can put that into what we call a feature store that then can be used by other teams and other ML models. So once you have this sort of data as a first-class citizen, then it's much easier to start sort of weaving machine learning into your kind of products and processes by making use of this data. And then all of this, obviously, also there's all this talk about and necessary talk about sort of ethical AI ML principles and also being aware of regulations like GDPR in the European Union or CCPA in California, that you want to make sure that these systems sort of are, the technical term is, you need to show that they don't have a so-called disparate impact on protected classes, right? But it basically means that they're sort of neutral and there's a side where so when you create a certain model, there are certain features that you don't want to look at. At the same time, from a compliance perspective, you still need to know what those features are to show that there's no disparate impact. But that's done by different teams.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you do that, so provide broad ML training, brainstorming about what ML can do for you, treat data as for first-class citizen, then you can start doing some cool ML-driven. Initially, it could just be some like smart defaults, personalization, and then over time, you can have almost like entire divisions, like Square Capital, which is sort of the arm within Square where we facilitate loans to our sellers, you can basically argue that that's pretty much all driven by ML. Because Square Capital is a great example where we can really show that the purpose, the overarching purpose at Square, we call it economic empowerment. And that means making sure that making it easier for everyone to be able to participate in the economy and to have very clear understanding of what the sort of what the processing fees are, exactly what is expected and there's no sort of hidden fees or issues like that. A good example of this is how Square Capital just looks at how a seller is doing within our platform. We don't necessarily need to go out and check your, FICO score or your history outside. We just look at, how you've been doing within Square. And that has allowed us to basically facilitate these loans to many sellers to expand their business.
On this idea of data as a first-class citizen, does that automatically mean just kind of save everything, or are you still needing to be very selective as to what you save, how long you retain it, compliance implications, all of that? How do you balance those considerations?
There's a good point. Your initial instinct might be, well, let's just save everything, but that quickly becomes unmanageable, right? If you look at the log files generated by every single service, and we have hundreds if not thousands of services, so even there's some operational logs and stuff that you just retain for a little bit. But then there's the important piece, more of kind of the semantics of this user logged in and they had these transactions. That is certainly recorded. So there is a little bit of certainly sort of filtering of the important actions. And then there's also a lot of what I was mentioning before of kind of converting these raw data into more useful aggregates.
Yeah, I'm still curious about, given all of the places that you are, trying to make an impact at Square, how does your particular team, you run an ML organization as opposed to engineering, a particular feature, or I'm trying to get at the relationship between your organization and the product teams, and are you kind of embedding people? Are you kind of a centralized organization that that takes on ownership of ML capabilities, that get plugged into other features? Like, how does all that work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question because it's really a bit of a fluid situation. So a couple of things there. First of all, Square is very much product oriented, and so ultimately what really drives the adoption of machine learning is how well it can serve the ultimate function of, overall is economic empowerment, make the life of our sellers easier, and create in the parlance of these sort of remarkable or delightful experiences that really make it sort of almost fun to use, a Square software. So that is the ultimate sort of driver. And so we see ML as an enabler to that. And the question about how exactly do you do that? So there's both sort of kind of vertical and horizontal in the sense that, first of all, we do want every engineer at Square to be at least aware of machine learning, right? In the same way that you want every engineer to be InfoSec conscious, right? Aware of information security issues. And when you develop an API, how do you check that you're not being hacked? We also encourage all engineers to get more familiar with what ML is capable of. Now, we do also have teams that are sort of, highly skilled data scientists and ML engineers, and they can sort of drive more of that. But typically, so we have some teams that are almost like all data science ML, but then the other idea that we're increasingly doing is kind of in the same way that you, in order to have a full stack team, you need back end and you need front end. Well, you will also add some ML expert or some engineer that has a more interest in ML to kind of balance the team.
Is there a typical project or a way that you engage with these product groups to help deliver new ML capability?
Yeah. So yes, typically there's an assessment of kind of the backlog, like what all the features are already sort of planning to do. But then we also do these brainstorming sessions to kind of bubble up some new ideas. And then of course there's this interesting sort of assessment of the idea in terms of, well, what is the expected impact, but also how feasible is it from a ML perspective, right? And also, do we have enough data for the model to be able to make a good decision? And so we go through a bit of that, and then we kind of select the sort of the most promising projects. And then we typically, a good model that we have found is that the ML team is responsible for kind of the back end, kind of computing these suggestions or being able to respond to all these different messages from buyers. And then the product team that owns that sort of that's the surface of the product surface that we're talking about kind of ends up owning the feature, but basically they make calls to the back end that is managed by an ML team.
Yeah, one of the issues that I think that kind of relationship raises is that, you know, there's so much crossover in terms of the way machine learning originated information is surfaced to users. And do you express a degree of certainty, you know, on a probabilistic determination? And if so, how, you know, right. There are all kinds of design issues that come into play
there. Yeah.
You know, is that something that you think a lot about there, or how do you approach that?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. As I mentioned, so fundamental to how we approach the development of an ML-driven feature is how is it going to look like? What's the experience going to be, both when the model is accurate and most importantly, what happens when the model fails, right? Mm-hmm. And failing, there's two ways of failing. Failing because there's no suggestion that is above a certain confidence threshold.
Yeah.
In which case they're like, there's no suggestion. That's one situation. And then the other one, which is obviously worse, is what happens when the suggestion is incorrect, right? And there's different degrees of that. So for example, in the case of item suggestion, you know, what is the worst that could happen? Well, you know, you're a bakery and instead of suggesting a croissant, we suggest a sock, right? Well, a little bit odd, but not the end of the world, right? So in that case, we can be a bit more lenient. On the other hand, for something like, you know, the credit, you know, issuing a loan or not, we have to be quite accurate in terms of modeling precision versus recall and the cost of a false positive. For example, a seller that would not pay us back versus a false negative, a seller that would have benefited, but we didn't issue a loan. And so ultimately, it's kind of a business decision, but it's highly informed by the model and being able to kind of set the correct operating point. To your point, it's certainly something that we have sort of front and center is the design of the feature and being able to make sure that overall the product and the feature is still useful even when the model makes a mistake. That's can go a little bit about the sort of these four aspects that we think about when designing an ML-driven feature. Certainly, the design and the UI and the different sort of experience. The other one is the modeling, right? So how can we make the model more accurate? How do we make sure that it actually improves over time? And that typically means that we also have kind of a product analytics layer that kind of looks at how the adoption of that feature and how often those suggestions get accepted or not, and that feeds back into the model. And then the other piece is sort of engineering, right? Sometimes you may have a very complex model, but then when you need to run it not for one user but for millions of users, then you suddenly realize that maybe you need something a little bit simpler so that it's actually, you know, computationally tractable.
I'm curious, when you kind of look across your portfolio of models, what is the what's the technology mix? You know, the Square is obviously working with a lot of kind of traditional tabular data. Does that mean you're tending to use, you know, more traditional techniques, or do you have a significant deep learning footprint? How do you think about the technology landscape?
Well, so it's interesting because on a per task basis, you always want to start with the simplest model possible, right? It's sort of very sort of alluring to say, oh, we're going to move everything to deep learning. But in fact, if taking a weighted average of of what happened in the last 2 weeks gives you a good sense, you don't need a super complex model. And certainly when we started, you know, now the company is 11 years old, there wasn't even like deep learning at the time. So certainly some of the models are, you know, quote unquote, like simpler, you know, like the XGBoost, et cetera, et cetera. But over time now, we also have some very sophisticated models that do use things like, you know, RNNs and CNNs. But we always sort of compare and contrast, kind of making sure that sort of the additional complexity is worth it and that the accuracy actually goes up.
Are there any particular examples of places where you found that the additional complexity was justified because the problem was, you know, that, you know, interesting or complex or nuanced?
Yeah. So I'll give you a relatively simple example, but going back to these item suggestions, we basically, you know, rather than trying to do some like simple, I don't know, like TF-IDF, you know, like word frequencies and stuff, we just trained our own embeddings, right? So we applied something similar to Word2Vec for in the description of the items. So we have usually an item has a category like pastry, the item is the croissant, and then the variations are in your favorite order, chocolate, almond, plain. Although some people call it butter instead of plain. So to make it less plain, they call it butter.
Yeah.
And so, but so you put all of these, you know, these millions of descriptions together and you train a Word2Vec, which is basically you learn these vector representations in this hyperdimensional space that is very sort of semantically true to the semantics. So interestingly, when we do that, we realize that even though, say, small and large are kind of opposites of each other in general English, within the context of these item catalogs, small and large are actually semantically very close, and literally they are geometrically close in this hyperdimensional vector space. And that is because in this case, both small and large encode a value for the attribute size, right? Which can be applied to a coffee or to a t-shirt. And so this is how we kind of approach some of more sophisticated models, but we kind of make sure that it works. And also one thing to add is we recently, so Square recently acquired Dessa from Toronto, where they have a lot of deep learning expertise. In fact, they were famous for some cool sort of deep fakes. And so we have a lot of ideas about how to apply some of more of these sophisticated techniques to both the Square Seller POS and also to Square Cash, the Cash app.
What kind of tooling and technology platforms have you established to allow your data scientists to, you know, move more quickly, be more agile, get models into production more repeatedly?
Yeah, this is also evolving. As you can imagine, in the beginning, and also because Square is fairly decentralized, we have sort of different teams exploring different solutions. Yeah. But it's also a combination of we have our own data centers, but we also use quite a bit of cloud, both AWS, GCP. And so you could, roughly speaking, we do a lot of the training and model development in the cloud. But when it comes time to serve, we still serve from our data centers. Not as an absolute, but as, you know, kind of overall. And then in terms of making it easy for internally
that proximity to feature data or some other factor that has that split?
Also kind of historical reason. And like we do have for some of the core services, we do want to maintain sort of full control. We have a good record of sort of availability and we want to maintain that. And then we have kind of a platform team that is developing some things like, you know, hosted Python notebooks and some feature store and some data infrastructure that is sort of used across all the teams. And then each team also has a, each team also has some sort of the freedom to use slightly different, you know, tech stacks depending on their preferences. But we do have a very sort of active internal sort of community where we get together every week and we sort of share the different projects across the different teams and units so that people are aware of sort of best practices and we can collaborate.
Are the folks in your org primarily engineers or data scientists or a mix?
Yeah, it's a mix because at the end of the day, we're still shipping features, right? And so we can partner with product teams or to some extent, we now also have ML heavy teams that end up being full stack because that's also maybe a faster path to productizing a feature. A good example is this conversations team, right, that is responsible for Score Assistant. They are extremely sort of ML AI heavy, but now they also have front end engineers to help them get the product out faster.
And so when you think about that spectrum of ML heaviness or readiness and kind of a role or an organization that's focused on ML, you know, that's ML in the name, like head of ML, you know, being your title, like is ultimately, like, do you think that your role is to put yourself out of a job by making the product teams, you know, so self-sufficient that, you know, it's ML is a kind of a corp capability? And if so, like, you know, what's the timeline on that? Or do you think that standalone ML organizations are kind of long-term, you know, have a long-term sustainable role? And if so, kind of what do you think that is?
Right. Yeah, I do like a lot the idea of basically increasing the overall skill set of engineers and product managers and designers about ML. And mm-hmm. So ultimately, that is my goal. That doesn't mean, though, that obviously there's going to be always a core that is sort of more following the latest developments and doing some research of their own. Mm-hmm. But I think that's certainly to make a product feature successful, you cannot have too much of a separation between ML and product, right? It has to be more embedded.
I mean, it's certainly been amazing to see, you know, how quickly kind of innovation jumps from pure research academia into commercial environments. And, you know, your typical kind of, yeah, I guess just comparing it to, you know, other kind of technology waves that, you know, we've seen like mobile and cloud and these other things, like they didn't necessarily require people to read papers in order to, you know, have an impact. Whereas, you know, with machine learning, you know, when I'm talking to people doing kind of practical things to push a business forward, that often involves, you know, being aware of kind of the latest developments and research and using those to push kick the ball forward, push the needle forward, whatever the right analogy is.
Push the envelope. Yes.
Do you see that as well?
Yes. So to some extent, I mean, obviously it's amazing to have people that are super excited and following the latest research. And we do have, you know, paper reading groups that some of us participate in. Having said that, I would actually argue that there is also beginning to be quite a strong sort of a democratization process of ML. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what the sort of the usual suspects offer in terms of ML capabilities, they started with some basic, oh, we can do model hosting for you, right? Mm-hmm. But now it's not just model hosting, but basically there's some like ready-made models that you don't even need to like train yourself you don't even need to have almost like a training set. You can use sort of off-the-shelf things for, say, recognizing the license plates, right? Or analyzing driver's license. So to some extent, it's also going to be much easier in the future to use some of these models, and it's almost just kind of put these building blocks together, right?
Have teams at Square built products on third-party, you know, AI as a service types of models?
So yeah, typically not. Typically, because we are actually very protective of our data, right? So we typically like do our own models. Although, I mean, for certain, you know, explorations outside of the core business, certainly we kind of play with, have some prototypes with some external models.
I'm interested. I have more questions about kind of the, you know, all the stuff that we talked about, the relationship between your group and others and kind of the tooling and platform. You know, maybe a good place to go to start to wind down is, you know, just in terms of the things you've learned, kind of building and, you know, what was the team small when you arrived, or did you inherit a team even, or did you build it up from scratch? Or,
well, this specific team, the Commerce ML, I started as a, you know, as a single person, and then sort of growing over time. I think the most interesting lesson is there's certainly a lot of interest in how ML can improve the, you know, the day to day of both internal teams and our sellers and customers. But of course, the fun part is kind of identifying which projects are going to be the most relevant and be able to do some quick prototyping to kind of either validate or realize that that may not be a good path forward. So being able to kind of do some quick iterations is important. And the other thing was, as in any organization, there's always ways to improve the data quality, right? So not just the kind of the infrastructure and the pipelines, but also the type of data that is logged and how it is logged, so that other teams basically increase the clarity of the semantics about what that data is. Meaning, this team called this field, item description. But what do you mean by item description? Because there's the category, there's the variation. Does it include the price? So different people may have different assumptions about what that field means. And so also being able to have a kind of a consistent semantics across services and teams. This is, I'm not saying that we've solved it, but this is a sort of a ongoing and something that we've made huge advances on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned kind of being thoughtful about the types of projects that you go after. One of the often recurring themes that has come up when I've talked to folks that are kind of in this head of ML type of role is kind of balancing the practicality of your portfolio, but also kind of having some moonshot aspects of it that if/when achieved significantly can, you know, make a big dent and, you know, can be kind of game changers. Is that, do you think about it similarly and manage a portfolio in that way?
Yeah. We do want to have a mix of more sort of short-term, quote-unquote, realistic projects, you know, something that we feel is very doable. It's just going to take, you know, one quarter or two quarters or three quarters. But then there's also the kind of the longer horizon of more sort of, moonshots, as you called it, or just explorations of features that would be extremely cool if we could do this or that. So what we do is almost like the old famous, you know, the Google 80-20. So we do have some hack weeks, and we have some people devoting a certain amount of their time to more of these long-term projects. Mm-hmm. But you also need a bit of a balance. Typically the way I organize it is making sure that in any given quarter, we have some work done for some of these more long-term projects. And some of it is just sort of researching new technologies, doing some sort of just kind of mock-ups of how things could be if only we had this, or if we only that had that technology.
Are the long-term plays as equally product-driven as the short-term, or are they, you know, do they come from the product teams, like each of the product teams has their long-term vision, or are they, you know, more driven by the opportunity created by the technology and, you know?
I would almost say it's more like the latter. Like, so because the product teams already have a well-defined backlog, and some of it is already very sort of forward-looking. And so the thought experiment is more about, even in, you know, like a, the, you know, 3 to 5 years, not even, you know, 1 to 2 years, but like 3 to 5, where could we be? What are the general trends in society and in technology? I mean, frankly, like, you know, the whole COVID situation and working from home, that seems to, you know, it will stay here for quite a while. So how does society change because of that? And how can we sort of position Square to help our sellers in that environment? And also in general, you know, what kind of new forms of almost like human behavior are going to arise from these new circumstances?
Very cool. Very cool. Well, Marcel, thanks so much for taking the time to chat. If I do decide to start the SAM, you know,
the linguistics. Podcast. Yeah. 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 I can tell you some more anecdotes about funny languages like Gugur Imithir, where you cannot say I'm standing in front of SAM. I would have to say I'm standing northwest of SAM or something. Anyway, of course, this is all changed by remote technologies too. But but it's been a pleasure. And I thank you for having me on your podcast, Sam.
All right. Thanks so much, Marcel.
Take care.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. For more information on today's show, visit twimmelai.com/shows. As always, thanks so much for listening and catch you next time.